And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm delighted to welcome Tony Dieterlizzi back to the program today. Tony is an award-winning author and illustrator. He won a Caldecott honor for his adaptation of The Spider and the Fly, and he just might be most widely known for his collaboration with Holly Black, The Spiderwick Chronicles. Recently, he has concentrated on writing with his successful Wundla trilogy, but he's gotten back to picture books with his new one, The Broken Ornament, which is published by Simon & Schuster Books for Young Readers. Tony, it's been about 10 years since we last talked about Kenny and the Dragon. What all have you been up to in the past 10 years?
Holy cow, 10 years. I remember so vividly when I was writing Kenny and the Dragon, my wife was pregnant with our daughter. And at the same time, I turned 40 in 2009. So there's a lot of pivotal stuff started to happen for me in my life. And it affected all the books that I've wrote and told onward. So for instance, like I wrote this science fiction fantasy trilogy called, it started with the first book called The Search for Wundla. And it's about a girl who lives in a futuristic tech-heavy world, but the world is populated by all aliens. There's no really any other humans that she's aware of. As I was working on the book, it was inspired by, you know, like The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and Peter Pan. I mean, those were books that I loved as a kid. I wasn't sure how much kids were reading those now. But what I liked about them was they were about young heroines kind of leaving the comforts of home and going out into a Neverland or a Wonderland. And then those stories always ended with them returning home, and they'd be wiser, gain some kind of knowledge. As a kid, I was always depressed. Like even in the movie of the Judy Garland movie of The Wizard of Oz, when she goes to leave, I'm like, why would you want to leave? I mean, like, this is so amazing, though, the fantasy world that you're in, and your real world existence is kind of dreary.
But there's no place like home.
Yeah, but weren't they kind of her home? Wasn't the lion and the tin man in some ways I felt were kind of like their home? Because I think when you say that, how do you define it? You know, what is home?
Well, where the heart is, as the saying goes.
As the saying goes. But again, what is that? Is it your family? I mean, it's not a structure, right? Because people move all the time, but they're still home. I'm making air quote signs for your listeners.
And I'm flinching.
I kind of think home is family, but family doesn't have to be defined by blood. Mm-hmm. Maybe home is just where you feel safe, you feel loved or wanted or appreciated or cared for. And so I go back to the ending of that Wizard of Oz movie, and I'm like, those guys cared for her too. I'm not saying they superseded Uncle Owen and, no, not Uncle, that's Star Wars, Annie M and the other farmhands at the ranch, but I wondered about that. And so I wrote the science fiction trilogy about the girl doesn't get to go back. Once she leaves her home, once she leaves the place she was raised in, she can't go back. And the characters that she kind of meets along the way that become part of her life also in turn become her family. And I think it was the beginning of a middle-aged version of me asking a lot of questions and those gray areas. So the books, they were a lot of work, but I loved writing them. But they were mostly about asking a lot of questions. How do we fit in the modern man fit in the natural world anymore? How reliant are we on tech? And is that a good thing or a bad thing? And in the end of the day, again, where is our home? Is Earth our home? Do you know what I mean? Because I sometimes worry that if it is, we're treating it pretty bad. Those books, I ask those questions a lot to myself. Really, they don't really have it. They end, but it's not necessarily ending with a bow on it. And those are the books I loved as a kid. And the one that just popped into my mind is Watership Down, because Watership Down has got that great bittersweet ending. You know, they find this special place that they wanted to find, but at the end, you know, the black rabbit also comes and takes the hero away. And I loved that. It's like, you did the thing you needed to do, but now you're done. That feeling stayed with me the moment I finished reading that book, and I reread it every 5 years.
So have you read Marla Frazee's Little Brown yet?
I have.
Boy, that's a kicker of an ending, isn't it?
Yes. There's an ambiguous ending. I'm not brave enough to write a book that ambiguous. I mean, it's definitely a very ambiguous ending. And so I think it's great because it opens a lot of conversation. You'll talk about it afterward. And you want someone else to read it so that you can have someone to talk to about it. And so I applaud her for going for that.
I've had a teenager and an adult read it both, and they just both had stunned looks on their faces at the end.
Yeah. And I know, Marla, I'm going to guess, and I'm sure you'll be able to find out more, she's probably in a similar age bracket than me, done about the same amount of stuff career-wise. So that said, I can see the logic in some ways where she's reaching for of like, okay, I've done books. Books that have sold well, books that have told stories, books that have been made into movies. But now, like, what's the deeper stuff that I want to ask? And that's kind of where I'm at personally. It's like, I want to be able to tell stories that really peel some of the layers away and start asking just deeper questions about childhood, about parents, about the things that I think are important.
Now, in your book, trauma happens early on and there's a move toward resolution. So tell us about Jack and his family and Christmas that's coming up.
The new book, I mean, to give you an idea a little bit too, I think you'll appreciate this. I mean, normally for me, I can do a picture book. I can write and illustrate a picture book in about a year. And it's been a while since I've done picture books because the Wandla books took so much time for me to do. This one took over 2 years to write and illustrate because it was a combination, I think, of I haven't done a picture book in a while, this kind of deeper understanding or this aspiration to tell a deeper story. And also I was rusty. I was a little insecure about it, but it had started with Christmas a few years ago. We were setting up the Christmas tree. My wife, Angela, had bought a bunch of ornaments from Target or whatever. And Sophia was lacing the hooks on the glass balls and handing them to Angela and I. You know, we were making hot cocoa and John Denver and the Muppets was playing on the music. It was this great thing, this great Christmas moment. And you just hear this, poof, and I look over and Soph's kind of got her shoulders up and she's kind of like waiting, like, oh gosh, I'm so sorry. And the ornament, she had dropped one of the ornaments, it had broken. Two things happened at once. I was immediately her age. I remember dropping an ornament. I remember my dad being like, hey, you know, pay attention, those things cost money, you know, like, well, come on, you know, kind of thing, like, and feeling bad, like I ruined Christmas or I ruined the moment. Because for me, and I think it is for a lot of other children, decorating the tree is a really exciting part of the holiday because it's the acknowledgement of the holiday. It's the excitement's now starting to build, you know. And you, first of all, take the holiday all out of it. We're putting a tree in our house. Like that in of itself is really, really cool. Whether it's a fake tree, an artificial tree, or a real tree, we're putting a tree in the living room. And now we're going to decorate it with little toys and things. Like, I just thought that was such a cool idea. So Sophia drops this ornament. I kneel down and I say to her, it's okay. When you accidentally break a Christmas ornament, a Christmas fairy is born. And Soph smiled and we went on and decorated the tree. And I felt like it was just, wanted to diffuse the situation. And Angela looks at me, she's just got these like saucer eyes. And she's like, that's a book. That's like your next book. I'm like, no. Let's come on. John Denver's on and the Muppets are singing, you know, let's go back to decorating the tree. She's like, no, I think that's your book.
And you have to listen because she is key in your process.
She is very key. But the thing that's crazy is there's something about that ornament all in pieces. So I took a photo of it and I posted it on my social media and just said, when an ornament accidentally breaks, a Christmas fairy is born, or so I told my daughter, so she wouldn't feel bad. And the response was overwhelming from fans and family members and friends. And so it took like 24 hours of Ange going, that's your next book. And then that for me to go, maybe there's something there. Maybe, I don't know. So all I had was just this notion, almost like from Peter Pan, that like when a baby laughs for the first time, a fairy is born. It's kind of like that same kind of concept. And then now I've got to try to figure out, what do you do with that? That's a premise, but that's not a story.
But Jack's mother's reaction is not your reaction.
No, that's where the storyteller starts to kick in, right? And you start to figure it out. So I thought, well, wait, this was just a 99-cent ornament from Target. What if it was like a family heirloom? What if it was like the last of a family heirloom? And so when I thought that, I thought, okay, now there's something there. I can create some tension. And it wasn't working. It's that fine line. I got to be honest with you. I think about like how, not dark, but how almost edgy Maurice Sendak could push it in his books with how bratty the kids could be, how disrespectful for the adults could be, how the adults could act. And I wanted it to have something like that in the right in the beginning. And so you're trying to fine tune it. You're like, is this kid like a brat? Is he kind of a jerk? Does he care that he broke it? Does he not care? No, I don't think he's quite that kid. But I wanted there to be some emotion right away. And I couldn't figure it out. Angela has this little tiny egg timer that was her grandmother's, who's since passed. And Angela's grandparents were very key in raising her as a kid. And when her grandma passed, her grandfather moved in with her mom. And so they sold the house, got rid of all the belongings. And the only thing that she got was this little, it's like a little ceramic mouse holding the egg timer. And Ange was like, I've played with this thing since I was a kid. Like, it sits in our house in a glass curio cabinet. And I said, what if Sophia accidentally broke that? What would you do? And she's like, I would burst into tears and it would be hard to hide how angry and upset I was, even if it was an accident. And then I knew that's what's got to happen. But then you got to figure out why. And so, you know, you start to figure out, okay, this ornament meant a lot to the mother. And I liked that because it also made the mother a child at some point. And I think as a kid, sometimes, I mean, Sophia probably is the exception. She lives with a giant kid in me. But I think a lot of kids, they forget that their parents were the same kids that couldn't wait for Christmas and running around and excited and, you know, filling out their list for Santa and all that stuff. And so that kind of reverb through time, I liked a lot. That fascinated me. You know, I knew then I had kind of the emotional plot of the story was starting to form. And then I needed to take care of the fun stuff, the story, the physical story that was going to now kind of be layered on top of it. And I just thought, well, every kid wants more. That's what every kid wants. The most presents, the most things, the most this. And so I thought, oh, if I could figure out a way to marry these two concepts, maybe I've got something.
And just now, when you're thinking, you know, I've always thought of Christmas in terms of memories,
yes,
and tradition.
Yeah.
But the newness of the experience for the kids gives it a strange balance.
Yes.
In that it's tradition and brand new things happening all the time.
Yeah. The more I thought about Christmas, the more confused I was. I mean, I did, you know, read into the history of the holiday, where the holiday originates, where aspects of the holiday, why we as Americans celebrate, you know, where the trees came from, where our imagery of Santa Claus, how it was formed, all those things. But a lot of it has morphed and changed in the 21st century and in America and how we celebrate Christmas. And the truth is, a lot of families, there's a lot of things we do the same, and there's a lot of things that families do differently. And so I had to try to find a story that could adapt to any, however you celebrate that holiday. And so in the end, really, when you take the trappings of the holiday away, it's about a child who accidentally breaks something that means a lot to his mother and has no, he's almost a materialistic, you know, he's just a kid who wants more. I mean, it could have been a birthday. It could have been a lot. It didn't necessarily have to be Christmas. And I think so, in doing so, he's left with learning. It's that turning point. And I remember this as a kid, and I remember it seeing it in my daughter, that moment that they make you a gift and they can't wait to give it to you. They're so excited. I put my hand in the clay and I painted it and I hung a ribbon and I can't wait to give it to mama for Christmas. That switch was what I was fascinated in, where the feeling of making someone feel better by acknowledging them with, to me, it's almost not a gift. It's a token of, you mean a lot to me, you're important to me, and let me show you how. So it's quality, right? It's not quantity. And so he figures that out in this story.
Now, are you familiar with the old country singer, Jimmie Rodgers, the Singin' Brake Man?
Well, I know who he is. I couldn't quote a song for you, though.
Well, one of his most famous songs is called Blue Yodel Number 1, okay. T for Texas.
Okay.
And I adapted the lyrics for the book. And T is for Twinkle, T is for Tannenbaum. T is for Twinkle, T is for Tannenbaum. T is for Tinsel, and that fairy made a wreck out of me.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And with your deep baritone voice, it sounds amazing.
And Tinsel is the fairy that comes, and she is enthusiastic about her job.
Yes, yes, she is. She's Angela. She's my wife. We would do voices, and she would do this almost like Megan Mullally from Will and Grace, this kind of real squeaky, sarcastic voice for her. Oh, I don't do wands, you know? And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's great. Like, so how do I capture that bubbly kind of effervescent, but a little bit snarky attitude in this little tiny dynamo? I could write her, and it didn't take long to figure out how to write her as a character, but it took a real long time to figure out how to draw her and what she should look like. They started from very organic, leafy, petally looking spiderwick type insect fairies, all the way to Glinda, the good witch from Wizard of Oz, and everything in between. It just took a while to kind of match the visuals with her so that it looked like she could live in a world of flying reindeer and Santa's helpers and the Big Claus himself. So it took a little while to kind of figure that. And everything I do, I want to look old because I always look back at old art and stuff, and that inspires me so greatly. So it was also looking at that, but then figuring out how to make it appeal to a modern reader.
And Jack's father has a little bit of a 50s vibe going on to him.
He does. He does. Someone said he looked a little bit like John Hamm from Mad Men, which I thought was a great compliment. It was the furthest from my mind. Jack's parents were inspired by my grandparents. While I was working on this, we had done an event in Lucca, Italy, which was an amazing experience. And I've been to Italy before. And I met some Dieter Lietzis who had never left Italy, but my great-grandfather immigrated with my grandmother from the Bari Peninsula into upstate New York, which is where my dad was raised and stuff. And my grandfather, also a Tony, so we were all big Tony, little Tony, medium-sized Tony, there's a bunch of Tonys, married my grandmother Mary, who was of Irish descent, the Davises. So I used that. That really inspired me. I think it was on a lot of people's minds, still is at the time when I was writing this book. And I thought a lot about that. And so I tried to make them as like an homage to my own heritage.
Now, the art in the book is lush and just deep backgrounds and beautiful paintings and vibrant. But there's the one scene where the ornament falls.
Yeah.
And the background is whited out and you just have Dad, Mom, Jack, the ornament and the tree and a white background.
Yeah, what'd you think of that?
I mean, it felt like time was just locked.
Frozen. Thank you. I wish I could take credit for that. I have to give all that to Angela. So the way I work when I'm doing the rough book dummy for this and the sketches and when I did the final for this one, because there were a lot of complicated images, I ended up almost working like an animator where I would paint the background of a room and then I would paint the character separate on a separate piece of board. And then in Photoshop, I would put them together. It just allowed me the freedom to kind of nudge things around, adjust colors, adjust lighting, and do a few special effects to kind of put that magic in it, especially like Tinsel's magic trail. So when I was doing the sketches, I would sketch almost like a color form. I would sketch this big scene. Then I would, on a separate piece of paper, I'd sketch all the characters. And then as I'm laying out the book dummy, I'm looking at the margins, I'm looking at the gutter, I'm looking at the boxes where the text goes. And so you're kind of moving, you're adjusting the composition accordingly to make sure, you know, the kid's not near the gutter, going to get sucked into the gutter of the book, or the action's happening too close to the text or too far from the text, you know, all those things. And so I was really struggling with the image where he breaks it, because I wanted originally this 2-page spread pan of their living room fully decked out with all the Christmas trappings. So the tree's up, the wreath's up, the lights are up, the gingerbread house, all the things. And then in the middle of it, you have him, you know, a shaft of light coming in from the window and it's glistening on the ornament as it's falling to its doom. And I just could not get all the pieces to intersect properly. And Angela came in and I'm showing it to her and I'm frustrated. And she said, hold on a second. She goes, so in Photoshop, you can click these images off and on. She goes, click off the background. So I turn the background off and it's just the characters. And she's like, that's your illustration. And I'm like, what? No, no, no. You need to see all this stuff. No, you don't. You've seen it in the page before and you're going to see it in the page after. You don't need to see all that stuff. We know what that stuff is. Every house in America has that stuff. We know what that stuff is. You don't need to see that stuff. She was right.
Because you automatically know something is happening.
Yeah.
When you see all that white.
Yeah. Yeah. It is that moment that, like, it's the slow motion thing. And it would, no, like that whole thing. And so she was right. It was a pretty amazing suggestion. And I think the beauty of our relationship is that she can speak so frankly to me. I'm often so immersed in the books and the things that I'm working on. I'm so close to it that I can be a bit myopic and not necessarily be able to step back and kind of look at it from a fresh set of eyes, so to speak. And so oftentimes she'll come in and she'll be like, what if you do this or do that? I don't often want to hear it. But in that case, it was a slam dunk. It was a good suggestion.
Now, I also really like the way you handled the Christmas lights on the tree on the wide shots.
Oh, thank
just,
you.
Just those little primary dots. I thought worked so well.
There's, you know, the funny thing is the colors of Christmas, the more I looked into it, the colors of Christmas weren't really red and green. It's strange how that becomes so synonymous with the holiday.
There are many different color combinations for Christmas. Because you have your red and green, you have red and gold, blue and silver.
Yep.
Because we've stolen that from Hanukkah, I guess.
Yeah, you're right. Yes, you're right. Those primary Christmas tree light colors, warm gold. Like if you think about Christmas night in or Christmas Eve in any house, usually it's kind of dimly lit or low lit. The lights are on. There may be a fire in the fireplace if you're in a place that's cool enough to have that. But all my memories of Christmas Eve, it's kind of dark and it's low lit. And there's maybe candles and music and things like that. Or it's festive. But even still, you're in a house at night and it's warm lighting. So it's a lot of warm color, actually, when I think of the real true thing. And so the book definitely has a bit of a color shift as it goes on. It starts out kind of bright and cheery, and then it kind of goes into these really dense, rich colors as the magic that the fairy causes happens. But by the end, it's these really saturated, warm, almost sepia with these pops of primary for the Christmas tree to kind of just give you that warm, cozy Christmas feeling.
Now, when we talked about Kenny and the Dragon, you said there's kind of like a motto that guides a book, and that was a warm cup of tea in an old battered armchair.
Wow, you remember that? Awesome.
I went back and listened to the interview. So was there a controlling motto for this one?
I think the motto was, it started early on, and with apologies to Chris Van Allsburg, but someone had early on read the book and said, oh, this is like the Polar Express. And we were like, no, this is nothing like the Polar Express. This is more like Jumanji. And so that kind of became kind of the catch. Like I'm trying to attempt to do a Christmas holiday version of Jumanji. Every book has its own strange little journey that it goes on. And so sometimes I have a very distinct vision in my head, like Kenny and the Dragon. And sometimes like this one, I had to work a little harder for it and kind of dig for it. But I hope that the results are something that show in the book and that people can respond and they can see where I was going with it.
Do you have a singular Christmas memory from when you were a child?
Oh, man. My dad was really good at the holidays. So my favorite one that I still remember, he's such a jokester. So one year, I'm going to guess I was probably, I was maybe 8 or 9 years old. Aurora was a model company that made these snap together models, which I loved. I don't know if you remember these.
And then Revell.
And then Revell, yep. And later there was Revell and Monogram. And they had this line of dinosaur models that they made. And I was a huge dinosaur nut as a kid growing up. I mean, I loved watching The Land of the Lost and 1 Million Year BC and everything. Anyway, they had these model kits called prehistoric scenes, and you could get like a model of a triceratops or a woolly mammoth or a saber-toothed tiger. And the one to covet was this Tyrannosaurus Rex snap-together model. And the thing was huge. I mean, it had to stand about 2 feet tall, and I guess with the tail, you know, it was probably maybe a good 3 feet long. I mean, it was a great, great model. There was a local hobby shop, and they would have it in the window. Every birthday, I want that. Can I get that Tyrannosaurus Rex model? Well, we'll see. And didn't get it. So I had it on my Christmas list. I think it was one of those, the tactic I used was like, when I make my list, I'm literally putting this on the list and nothing else, right? So we go, we open our presents. We open the presents that my parents got. We open the presents that Santa brought. And we're going through all the presents. I'm getting socks and books and art supplies, all those things. And we're all done. No Tyrannosaurus Rex. And my dad's like, did you have a good Christmas? It's like, yeah, it was good. Did you get everything you want? Yeah, okay. He drops something on the ground. He goes, oh, there's something under the couch. And I look under there, and I could tell as soon as I saw the box, I knew it. He's like, oh, this one must have just fallen under the couch. And there it was, the Tyrannosaurus Rex. So now that I say it, it almost reminds me of in Christmas Story when he gets the,
it's very, very
Gene Shepherd, yeah. It really was. I ran around with that thing. It was like holding a dog in my 8-year-old arms. It was so big. I loved it literally until it fell apart into pieces. Such a great thing.
I was delighted to see in one of the scenes of the book that Kenny and the Dragon made a little cameo.
Oh, nice. You caught that. That was for you. I did that for you. I knew I was thinking of you. No, I try to hide Easter eggs. I love an Easter egg in a movie. It's really kind of acknowledgement to anybody who's been following my books for my whole career. So there's other hidden stuff in Broken Ornament as well. Arthur Spiderwick makes an appearance. Mary Howitt's silhouette, her cameoed silhouette from The Spider and the Fly, can be seen. Ted from my second picture book is also there, as well as a robot from G is for One Gazonk, which was a silly alphabet book I did years ago. So lots of little homages throughout.
Did you have challenges in putting that much snow in the book and keeping it interesting?
So there were some challenges. It's funny you mentioned that. The snow was not it, but the stuff that was the hardest for me that was are things that I just don't do well drawing are crowd scenes with lots and lots of characters and interiors of rooms and buildings. That stuff just does not come naturally to me. I'm not very good at visualizing non-dramatic perspective. So not like that comic book perspective that you see where buildings are looming. Like when you're in a room, in a smaller room, the perspective is much more subtle. It's there, but I struggle with that. I think I'm a much more organic artist. I'd rather be drawing, you know, creatures and organic shapes, but I really wanted to challenge myself and see if I could do, you know, massive crowd scenes and interiors. So I consulted actually with a couple people beforehand while I was doing it. I got to speak with David Wiesner. Your listeners can't necessarily see the book, but all this Christmas magic gets unleashed in the house. And so I wondered how much of the house I needed to show, like how many lamps, how many sofas, how many clocks, how many of those sorts of things I needed to put, because the average living room is probably ours is pretty cluttered with all kinds of stuff. And so I just wasn't sure how much of that I could put. And David was like, listen, the more mundane you make the house look, the more magical the elements are going to appear. So when the snowmen come walking in and when the reindeer come flying in, they're going to appear that much more magical. So you really want to show like an average living room, but you also want to have the artifacts and the landmarks that you would have in a living room, but you also want to be able to leave enough room so that you can have, you know, a snowball fight kind of thing. And I also talked to Bill Joyce, William Joyce, a little bit about it. Great people, by the way, incredibly supportive, which is very meaningful to me because I was coming out of art school when those guys were making masterpieces and stuff. So I looked up to them coming out of art school. One of the rules in the book that I had was, you know, the living room was this pretty small living room. And I wondered if it could get bigger when the magic happens. And Bill Joyce and I had a long conversation about that. And he's like, I think you could. I think when the once they enter the kind of magical Christmas zone, I think you can start playing with the scale of it and stuff. So
we've been lucky to have both of those gentlemen on the show.
Fantastic. That's awesome.
And we had Bill on for Ollie's Odyssey.
Nice.
And yep. David for Fish Girl.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Incredible influences. I mean, feel very fortunate in that I have an incredible, you know, connections with other people who make books for children. The book's actually been written like twice. In the first draft, there was a lot of problems with it, and I couldn't. It's almost similar to what I was saying earlier, where Angela saw something that I couldn't see, and so it was with this early draft. I'd done an entire book dummy, and there was something wrong with the book. And I sat down with Mo Willems, who lives one town over from where we live in Amherst. And we had lunch, and Mo asked how the book was coming along, and I showed it to him. I said, something's wrong with it, Mo, but I can't figure out what it is. And he flips through it, and he goes, oh, you've written like the perfect midlife crisis book. He's like, you've made the parents the protagonist and not the kid. And that's all he had to say. As soon as he said that, it was like a switch going off. I knew exactly how to go and fix the book. And I also thought that shed a light on and why his books are so incredibly endearing to younger readers, because he understands. He's always putting children first and foremost in his mind when he's making books for kids. Holly Black, who I teamed up with on the Spiderwick books, gave it a read, and she's such an incredible editor as well as an incredible author, and she knows me well enough that she was literally, I'll give you an example. There was the original line when Jack meets Tinsel the Christmas fairy. Jack asks her, are you a fairy godmother? And she said, oh, no, I don't do wands. And Holly read it and said, oh, you know, that's good. She goes, but I think you could push that even more. They don't trust me with a wand. That's brilliance to me. Like, I'm going to change literally like two or three words, and it's going to totally just blow this thing out into a bigger story, a bigger landscape, because it alludes to so much more. The other person that comes to mind that's a children's book author and illustrator was Jeannie Birdsall, who wrote the Penderwicks. And Angela had lunch with Jeannie, and same as all these other amazing people, been very supportive of my books. And Jeannie actually caught a timeline problem with it that I had completely missed. So I'm looking at Christmas reference from the turn of the century. I found photographs online of homes in the 1900s celebrating Christmas right up to, you know, last year, the house with all the synchronized music and everything in between, and the stuff that I was buying, like, loads of old vintage Christmas photographs from like 1950s, probably from someone's photo album. I'm very obsessive personality. So when I'm on my project like this, I want to consume all sorts of stuff. And the studio is decorated in mercury glass ornaments and all this stuff. So a lot of when I did the flashback scene for when the mom was younger, the tree and everything looked like it was a 1950s era or an early 60s era. And it was Jeannie who said, wait, how old is the mom? And when does everything happen? Because I thought we were in a modern era, but now you're going back to when the mom was a kid. So are we like in the 80s? Like, where is this? It's again, that kind of stuff that you think about, but sometimes it's hard to catch every single thing. And so I'm very fortunate to have that incredible ring of people who care, who also create incredible stories for children, to be able to have my back.
Now, back with tinsel, and she's not trusted with wands.
Nor is Angela, right? I would say she'd probably do as much mischief as she would good.
But I would think, you know, the emotional grief she has because of the broken ornament, I think both she and her husband would share the tremendous grief of the hardwood floors being pushed up by Christmas trees and snow melting into water damage everywhere as well.
Being an insurance claims adjuster's nightmare, right? Coming out and seeing all that. I asked myself, what would be magic? I think it goes back to what we were saying about the whole idea as a kid, having a tree brought into your house, whether it was an artificial tree being assembled or bringing a tree in from outdoors and putting it in a stand. And so why not a forest, you know, and why not fake snow, but real snow? I think all the things, I just had to rewind and go, what would I have loved as a kid, and ask my daughter what would she think would be really cool to see, be able to kind of have that abandon in it, which sometimes gets a little harder to do. You know, I've often thought that the 10-year-old or the 9-year-old version of me that I'm trying to impress, every year I get a little better at doing what I'm doing. But it's another year I'm further away from that kid. It's kind of the irony. So it's good to have children in my life, and Sophia and her friends, and visiting schools and libraries and stuff, to be around kids and be reminded of a lot of the small stuff. But also that way of seeing the world is very key, at least for me, in the stories that I want to tell.
I've been kicking an idea around in my head recently, and I'm thinking, do I have memories of my childhood, or do I have memories of the photographs of my childhood?
So I've read a lot about that. I'd read that a lot of us, the memories are oftentimes molded by photographs, or not only that, but photographs with like our parents or someone telling, oh, that's when, you know. So I agree with you. There's certain stuff I feel like is lost to me now too, which was triggered though when Sophia would go through various ages. I'm like, oh my gosh, I totally forgot about this thing, which has been kind of nice. But yeah, I love photo. I love taking photos, but I also love having photos and photo albums. And I've often joked that if the house was on fire, forget the art, I'm going to go grab the photo albums, the old photo albums. But boy, it's interesting you bring that up, because that, in some ways, that's key to this book, right? And to this story, is that memory and a visual, something visual about that memory and triggering the memories. And I think that the holidays bring that on more. I don't know if it's because it's the end of the year, and so you enter a state of reflection, especially as adults. As kids, I never did, at least. I was excited about what Santa was going to win.
You weren't sitting there pensively going,
when
I was three.
But I always create stories with the idea or the hope that there's an adult involved with the story, whether they're reading it to a child, so it could be a parent, a teacher, a librarian, et cetera, or they're reading it together, or the child's reading it to them. I mean, that's certainly what I grew up with. It's what Sophia and I have enjoyed. And so I think of like, what's a storyline that can appeal to an adult as well as the storyline that's appealing to the child. That is definitely kind of the part of the holidays that, at least for me, I become very reflective. I would imagine it is for a lot of folks, that you think about the year, think about all the things that happened, and then you also think further out what things that have happened in your life.
I'll send you a link for a song. There's a Nashville singer-songwriter named Liaza, and she had a song last year called Christmas, and it is just one of the most sad and reflective Christmas songs I've heard in a long time. It just is...
Like a good sad?
It's an overwhelming sad.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, I mean, it's in some ways it can be a mile marker for the year. I can't always remember what I got every Christmas, but I can certainly remember Christmases where we didn't have a lot of money, and then Christmases where we had some money. I can remember Christmases where my brother was really sick one Christmas, like he had pneumonia and was like bedbound. It's interesting how you can remember certain aspects of your family and where they were and in your childhood. It's kind of like what we were talking about with One Life. As a storyteller, I don't know the answers either. So I'm trying to ask the questions, and it may feel like there's a bow on it at the end, right? I mean, in this, you have a protagonist who changes, right? The little boy at the beginning just thinks the more I get, the better the holiday is going to be. And then by the end, he gives something meaningful to his mom and has a feeling that's a more powerful feeling than he's ever had. But there's still open strings that aren't tied up, loose ends in that story. And that's the stuff I like, which is like, why did that? What happened to the other ornaments that were in the box, and what happened with the mother and the grandmother and things like that? And I like that.
I was wondering where those other ornaments had gone over the years.
I had originally had a 2-page spread sketched where the mom aged. You'd see the mom age as each one inadvertently met its demise, leaving her with this box with the one. But you didn't need it. You just knew. And then it's... I think he says it. Oh, geez, there's a whole box of them, and now I just broke the last one. So that mystery actually, I feel like, is more enticing because of what you just said. Like, clearly something happened. Life.
But also, the kid, if he were particularly unkind, could say, well, I was just the last of six.
Yeah.
Made five mistakes before this one.
That's true. But see, you think about that stuff and you're like, this is why she's not hanging it on the tree, because it's too precious to her now. She doesn't want to risk that. And a deeper person may know psychologically why, what the symbolism is there. But I just felt like she's holding on to that memory. That's the thing that means so much to her. And in some ways, we've hit something, I think. She's also imparted a bit of materialism, because she believes, okay, this item is the memory, but it's not. The memory is the memory. Mm-hmm. And as evidenced by when he draws it for her, it still hurts. It's still horrible. But you know, no one's going to take away that moment, those memories.
And I really have to cut you off now because you have to go.
Good.
I could keep you here
more. Marathon.
But I've got to.
Man, it's
I don't want to be blamed for.
No, it's good. No, I could talk. It's good. It's always good stuff. Really good stuff. Thank you so much for letting me come back.
Tony, I want to thank you so much for helping us celebrate the holidays this year.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And hope it's not another 10 years before we get to talk again.
I hope so. That's been far too long. It's always good chatting with you.
Take care.
All right.
Tony DiTerlizzi is the author of The Broken Ornament, which is published by Simon & Schuster Books for Young Readers. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.